Everyone, it's Dave. Welcome to On the Market. Today, I'm joined by James Daynard. And James, thank goodness you're here today, because we are getting into a part of the real estate investing world that I truly know nothing about. We're going to be talking about receiverships, and you are really excited to talk about this topic. Why do you think this is important for our audience to know?
Right now, there's deal flow is really hard to find, and you know, as investors, we have to shake every branch right now to find that deal. And what we are seeing, or at least what we've been seeing, is we're buying a lot more product that's from investors that's half stabilized or half renovated, or, you know, investment deal that went bad and the lenders are trying to dump it off. And so we've been able to find quite a bit of inventory through receiverships. It's something that a lot of investors just kind of bypass. But you have to look at all these deals, because some of the best deals we've ever done have been bought out of receivership. And they've also been some of the smoothest deals we've ever bought as well.
Cool. Well, I'm excited to learn about it. And obviously, you know something about buying and selling with receivers, James, from your personal experience. But to help us understand this topic, we're bringing in an attorney, Jake Flothy, who is a receiver and has really intricate knowledge of the process side of receiverships, the legal things that you need to consider as an investor, and has some tips for you if you either find yourself in a situation where you need a receiver, or as a buyer, if you want to potentially buy a property in receivership. So with that, let's bring on Jake Flothy. Jake Flothy, welcome to On the Market.
Morning, guys.
Jake, as you're going to quickly discover, I know absolutely nothing about receiverships. So let's just start with the basics here. What is a receivership?
So a receivership is a court process where a receiver is a person, and it could be an individual or a legal entity that is considered a person, but it's a person that's appointed by the court to take control of the property of somebody else and administer it, typically for the benefit of creditors, sometimes for the benefit of the equity owners, like in the case of a partner dispute.
Okay, so the court dictates that for some reason, a property needs to be handled or handed over to sort of like stewardship to a receiver. You just said partnerships are one example of when that might happen. What are some other examples of why a receiver might get involved in a real estate deal or transaction?
A large portion of it is debtor and creditor instances. So when you have a debtor that's not paying as they agreed to, or the collateral is worth less than the debt and it needs to be liquidated.
Okay, got it. And so is this then in lieu of a foreclosure, or how does this sort of fit into the foreclosure world?
Yeah, so it's an alternative to foreclosure. Similar to a trustee sale, you can sell it through a receivership and wipe out subordinate debts. But different from the trustee sale is that we can actually get the properties marketed and expose them to the open market, where people can obtain financing and conduct due diligence.
Oh.
So they can make an informed purchase and we can get a higher, better value than is typically obtained at a trustee sale.
Okay. So just so I understand, in a trustee sale, it has to be sold sort of privately. It's not listed on the open market. People have to bring cash. But using a receivership, it sounds like you take that property and essentially you can list it on an MLS, or you go to private investors, and that allows potential buyers to seek traditional financing. And I guess in theory, that would allow the seller or the property owner to receive more because there's more competition for the property.
Correct. Yeah. And in addition to that, though, everything's overseen by the court. So say we do market a property and we get an offer that appears acceptable. We'd file a motion with the court, give notice to the creditors, to the equity owners, to all parties in interest, and they'd have at least 30 days to come to court and object or continue the bidding process and get a higher offer approved by the court.
And, you know, as far as an investor goes, a lot of times you're getting the same result as you would many times at the trustee sale. You know, if they take it to auction and it's a first position deed of trust, you can bid on it and it's going to clear out a lot of the other debts, except for sometimes the IRS lien can follow, or a couple other types of liens. But the big benefit for investors to buy a receivership over the notice of trustee sale is you get so much more due diligence on those properties because you can go inside them, you can run your feasibilities, you can have an elongated close rather than just a quick bring your cash to the auction and write a check. And so, you know, for an investor standpoint, it's very beneficial because you just have that little bit more time to kind of massage the deal, look at it, and have some more time to make adjustments on offers in case the debtors come back. Whereas that trustee sale, you're just bidding and you don't know what your price is going to be when you go down there to bid. And then you also don't know what's going to happen with the possession, which is a really big deal in today's market, especially for those metro cities where you have longer eviction laws. So, Jake, when you are working with investors, a lot of what the product is that's inside that you're working with, they're usually properties that are either over-levered or have some sort of symptom of distress that put them into that situation, whether it's repairs, it could be an investment gone bad. On most of the properties that you guys sell as receivers, are most of them financeable or is this stuff that typically needs to be closed in cash?
I'd say that most of them are financeable. There are a lot of properties that are occupied, whether it's by an owner or a tenant, but we have a lot of habitable buildings that are up to code. The market's open to everybody. You know, it doesn't have to be somebody coming to the courthouse steps with a cashier's check and a hard money loan to buy it from a trustee. They can get a traditional financing and, you know, be an owner occupant after that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense because there's all different types of financial situations that happen, right? And at the end of the day, there's financial stress and people need to clear off their debt. And in order for them to do that, they're selling their property or they're offsetting those costs with trying to cover as much as they can. And then essentially you're doing a short sale on the rest of the debts and getting them to accept the payoff. But it's going through more of the court process rather than a traditional short sale. Like in 2008 and 10, we went through a lot of different short sale processes where we'd work directly with the lender, submitted an offer, and then you'd be negotiating directly with that lender, getting appraisals and in the way that they want to check the value. Can you touch a little bit of how it's different from the traditional short sale to what you guys do? Because, you know, as a buyer and investor, I've always felt like buying a receivership sale via short sale is a lot cleaner than buying through a lender. Like it gets done a lot faster. It seems to move quicker. And it seems like the debtors move a lot faster when a receiver's involved.
That's right. It's a lot smoother. Back in the early 20-teens, I was involved with a number of short sales. It was a slow and tedious process, getting authorizations and continually talking to the bank and negotiating. But with a sale in the receivership, you don't necessarily need the secured creditor's agreement or acceptance of a lower offer because the judge is the one that decides whether or not an offer is ultimately acceptable and will be forced through. What we do is when we market the property, you know, we work with trusted brokers, we do our own market analysis and determine what a fair market value for the property is. And typically creditors or the creditors' counsel are pretty savvy to the receivership process. We just get a lot smoother and quicker cooperation and get deals closed a lot faster than we had previously with traditional short sales.
Because that traditional short sale can be a very long, painful process. We had some that we did. Some are years where we've been negotiating a short sale for years. Because once it hit that five, you know, a lot of states, they have a certain amount of time to sell a property at the auction. And then they have to refile. And it would be like this short sale process that we'd be doing, going to the refiling, updating the financials every month, getting that over to the bank. And it could take years. There was one, I think we closed, it took over 3 years to get it closed. And it really didn't make a whole lot of sense because the debt kept compiling on it. But it was just the process with the bank and how slow it was. And if the appraisal was even off by like 2%, they wanted to restart the process. And as a buyer goes, an investor, we like buying receivership sales a lot better because they're smoother, they're quicker, and you can kind of depend more on your offer price, or at least you get your answer back a lot faster.
Right. And it's... I'd say that there are fewer variables because one of the things that I recall from doing the short sale is that the secured bank was always concerned with the seller/owner debtor's financial situation and wanting bank statements and wanting to know essentially what their assets are. Whereas with the receivership, all that's irrelevant. Once it goes into a receivership, all we look at is what the fair market value for the property is.
So we do have to take a quick break, but stick around because we'll be right back. Buy low, sell high. Very easy to say, but not always so easy to do. For example, high interest rates are hurting the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices in a lot of markets are falling, even for many of the best assets. So it's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/pockets. Fundrise.com/pockets. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise flagship fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement. Whether you're a seasoned real estate investor or you're just looking for your first opportunity, we all know that having a top-tier lender is one of the most critical things on your checklist. The thing is that many lenders overpromise and draw things out. But with Center Street Lending, you can say goodbye to the roadblocks and focus on making money. With over $5 billion in funded loans, 240-plus five-star Google reviews, seasoned loan officers, and white-glove service, Center Street Lending provides smarter loans for residential investors and a fast track to success. Apply now at biggerpockets.com/centerstreet. That's biggerpockets.com/centerstreet.
This show is sponsored by Airbnb. Did you know that I turned one of my first homes into an Airbnb? It's true. And it even helped me get the extra income I needed to launch my real estate career. So if you want to try your hand at making even more income with your property, Airbnb is the place to be. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back to the show.
So why would a creditor choose a short sale instead of a receivership? Is it more expensive to do a receivership, or is it just they don't know that this is an option?
I think a lot of them might not know that it's an option. You know, I've seen a lot of weird loans where they're even with big traditional servicers that have just been in default with no action on behalf of the creditor for years. And I can't really make heads or tails of why they would want the loan on their books, but I've just seen a lot of inactivity from some creditors. If I were in the position of a creditor and there were subordinate debts on the property, I'd be all for getting the receivership rather than a short sale, because you don't have to negotiate with the subordinate liens. You don't have to negotiate with those. Whereas with a short sale, you'd have to get everybody on board to accept it and release their debt, right? But with the receivership, once you get the court order saying the property is being sold free and clear for a specific price, it's a done deal. And then the debts are paid in order of priority. So first in time, first in right. And you don't have to worry about the mechanic and material mens liens that might be a second or a third position.
What does a typical transaction look like that comes across, you guys are hired? What does that process look like? Timelines? How is the debt cleared? What do those loans look like as they're clearing off? Can you kind of walk our audience through that, how that looks, and then how that sale kind of is finalized with the court order?
So the process gets started by somebody filing a petition to appoint the receiver. And so it could be a creditor that files an involuntary petition. It could be the debtor that files what's called an assignment for the benefit of creditors. And you get a general receiver appointed that has the power of sale. So once the receiver is appointed, we compile a schedule of assets and liabilities so that we can assess what we're working with, whether it's a single piece of real estate or multiple, and who all the creditors are, both secured and unsecured. So once we have that data, then we send out notice to all the creditors that are identified, and we start evaluating the properties. We get them listed for sale. Say we get an offer that comes in, We analyze that offer, can negotiate and do counter offers to try and make sure that we get market value for the property. Once an acceptable market value offer is obtained, then we file a motion with the court to approve the sale at that price on those terms. And we send notice of the motion and the contract out to all the creditors and all the equity owners. And pursuant to the statute, that's a 30-day process. Somebody's entitled to 30 days notice before receivership property is sold. Then on the MLS, the listing gets changed from active to pending, backup offers requested, and the bidding process remains open until the judge is the one that slams the gavel down and says sold, essentially.
And on that bidding process, you know, to kind of, again, walk the investors through, because, you know, right now it's hard to find a deal or just trying to find inventory. And, you know, a lot of times finding a deal, you can pay full market value for it. And it's more about the condition of the property and you're improving it with your plan rather than getting it on a great, great price. What is that process like? Because receivership fees can change. As an investor, we're always kind of concerned, like, what's our all-in number on this property?
Yeah.
And you'll see it listed on, like, the MLS will be, you know, you can write it up. And sometimes there's like a 10% fee that gets added on, or a 20% fee, or there's, you know, there's like the beneficiary fees are added on top of the price. Can you touch a little bit of why those fees vary a little bit when you see it? Because you have to kind of look at each deal differently. And then where do those fees go? And how does that affect that bottom line, whether the investor's deal is going to go through or not? You know, because sometimes it's the deal can be make or break on that fee. If it's an extra 10%, it might not quite work. And, you know, for investors, we're just trying to get through that motion. Can you kind of explore those fees a little bit? Because I know a lot of people run into those as they're looking at buying these.
So with our company, Resource Transition Consultants, our fees are set pursuant to the court order, similar to real estate commissions, you know, as they were a couple of years ago. Our fees are paid out of the purchase price. So it'd be really easy for you to calculate what your all-in number is when you're looking at the property. It's going to be whatever you're offering to pay for the property. There wouldn't be a hidden fee that's tacked on.
Why is there such a variance in the fees sometimes? Like, because also as investors, we're trying to finance these deals a lot of times with hard money, and hard money lenders, they want their 20% down. And then sometimes they won't even include those fees in. And so you have to come up with that extra cash to kind of buy that deal. Can receivers kind of charge it in any type of structured way? Or is it, you know, I know, you know, I've been familiar with your guys' process. It's all included in the price. But what's the big delta on how they charge those fees?
The receivership process, you know, it's a creature. Now it's a creature of statute. Long, long time ago, it was a creature of common law. Within the legal field, there's just like you guys, I'm sure, are, you know, experienced in the real estate market. There's just kind of an open entrepreneurial spirit and variation from professional to professional. And so I guess that's the best answer I could give, is like somebody's fee structure might change just because they think that they can make more money that way, or make their, you know, either make more money on a transaction, or it makes the services that they're providing more appealable. So it's just a, you know, marketing and a personal preference.
Jake, I'd love to switch gears and just talk about what's happening in the receivership market today. How would you describe the state of the industry?
It's changing. I'd say it's ramping up. A few years back, there were a lot of owner occupants that were getting behind with their traditional mortgages. And so they'd file an assignment for the benefit of creditors, kind of as an alternative to doing a bankruptcy or trying the long and tedious short sale process that we've discussed. But lately, what I've seen a lot more of are investors. So it'd be an individual that has multiple properties, whether it's a builder or a flipper, that just acquires multiple properties that they're unable to complete or unload at their previous target price. They'd file a receivership and we get those properties liquidated for their creditors.
And that's where James jumps in.
It's those greedy performas. I mean, I think the market was doing so well and rates were so low that even the lenders, right? Like, we saw hard money lenders and private lenders getting very aggressive with leverage based on pretty packed performas on rent increases, on value increases. And then once those rates shot up, everything kind of hit the brakes for a minute. And because the debt, you know, when we're talking about more investment property, if it's a residential homeowner, A lot of them have debt that's 3.5% right now. And that kind of adds up over time. But when these investors are borrowing money at 10-12% and it's not being paid and it's compounding on itself, especially when it's midstream on a project, right? Like that, if the house is half stabilized, the value has gone down, not gone up many times. And then the debt that was financed at a very aggressive rate, where lenders were maybe financing 90% on these projects, are really exposed because the value's gone up, the debt cost has gone up, or the leverage, the LTV is a lot lower, and then it's just compounding on itself. And then that's where really the opportunity is as far as investors go too, because in today's market, one thing we have seen is the market has rebounded fairly well, but things that need work are still not selling at the pricing it was selling for. And I know for us, for investors, we've been targeting more half-built projects where investors are kind of trying to get out than rather than even targeting the homeowner that wants to sell, because there's a lot more inventory for us to look for. And in addition to working with those lenders and the debtors, they kind of know what they've lent on and they want to get a deal done. When you're negotiating with some of these lenders, because they're more short-term commercial debt, are they working a lot more to kind of discount the notes because they just want to get paid back in full? A lot of times they're paying investors at a higher rate too. So the more that compounds, the riskier position they're in. Are you seeing lenders just trying to move stuff forward and taking bigger shorts just to get it off their books?
Yeah, I'd say so. And I'd say that there's a lot of willingness to smudge the default interest. Recouping the principal is of an utmost concern. And when we're dealing with debts that can accumulate, default interest at 24%, there's quite a bit of motivation I've seen on behalf of the lenders to just get a deal done, because they've got the same understanding that I think we all do here, that there is a point of no return where you're not going to recoup your principal plus all the accrued interest. And they just need to get the property sold, get the cash back into their account so that they can disperse it to their investors.
So James, I'm actually curious, does that mean that when you work with a receiver, is it less competitive than a lot of the other deals that you're looking to buy?
I would say it's not less competitive because they're getting listed on the open market. I would say many investors, they want to buy on the now. They don't want to wait for that process, even though it's not that long half the time. And they might just go past the deal. Where I do see it's beneficial is, right now we're in a market that's kind of gradually rebounding. And when you're getting in contract, it can take 90 days to close this, 120 days to close it. And as the market conditions improve, the deal can actually get a little bit better when you're done stabilizing. And you don't see a lot of competition, but what you do have to watch out for are those nasty bump clauses where you get a deal, you think you're locked in, you're going to close, and then all of a sudden there's a bump where another buyer can bump you out of position on your deal, and you either have to come back and match their offer or resubmit at that point. Or even how, there's been many of times where, we've been on a deal, it's going to get to court approval, and another buyer shows up out of nowhere with an offer at the hearing. Can you explain that to the listeners a little bit? Like, how does that work? What happens when you get kicked off your deal, and how do you keep it under control if it starts to, you get those nasty bumps?
Yeah, well, those kind of late notice bumps are frustrating to everybody involved because, we have to keep the court apprised of what's going on. And we have a duty to try and get the highest and best offer available, get the highest and best price for the benefit of the creditors and any equity holders. That being said, it's a public sale process and everybody's aware when we're doing a transaction, we have them sign a specific addendum that identifies that, their offer is contingent upon court approval and it's subject to overbids up until the court approves a final sale.
That's super interesting. That would really bum me out if you thought you had something locked up and then, that's not how it works at the regular market. That would be very surprising.
We used to have bump day in our office where we would go through every different bankruptcy because you can see them because it says like backup requested, who the broker, it's a similar common, who the seller is. And every 30 days, we would underwrite every pending bankruptcy and just trying to bump people out, especially if we knew who was on the deal. It was like a game for us.
So you're like framing this, James, and you're like, oh, those nasty bumps. But you were the one bumping people.
Hey, you know what? Because you got to stay on top of the market. And if you just if there's something pending that's right outside the box, recomp it. I mean, there was a deal pretty recently. We had our initial offer and then the market started rebounding and we ended up getting in like a bumping war. And we went to our highest. And it was like $100,000 higher. And wow. It definitely can turn into, once you get in that bidding mindset, it kind of goes like you're going to the auction. Because when you go to the auction with those cashier's checks, you want to buy that property, you get all caught up in the moment. And it can definitely happen because that's where the juices start getting turned up. But yeah, you got to watch out for the bump clauses.
We have one more break, but stay tuned. On the Market, we'll be right back.
This show is sponsored by Airbnb. Did you know that a long time ago, before I ever started my real estate business, I turned one of my first primary residences into an Airbnb? And that's the extra income that I needed from Airbnb that gave me the confidence to go out and work for myself and eventually quit my 9-to-5 job. And now I have dozens of Airbnbs all over the country. I've even partnered up with the old David Green on a recent property in Scottsdale to take our portfolio to the next level. And of course, we host it on Airbnb. But you don't need to be a full-time real estate investor to start on Airbnb. As a matter of fact, I was self-managing 10 properties while working my 9-to-5 job, so I know anybody can do it. Think about it this way. You're looking for extra income and going on a vacation. Wouldn't it be great to rent out your space and let your property pay for itself while you're gone? I did this one time. I pitched my wife and my roommate, because we were house hacking, on the idea of renting out our home, and it paid for all of our expenses on a trip to Mexico City. So go and give it a try. It might just change your life, just like it did mine. And I really do mean that. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, real estate investors, whether you're a pro or you're just starting out, having a top-notch lender is crucial. That's something we can all get behind. And if you're tired of lenders overpromising and causing delays, Center Street Lending has your back. They have over $5 billion in funded loans, 240-plus five-star Google reviews, and experienced loan officers offering white-glove service. With all that, they make lending a breeze. Center Street Lending provides smarter loans for residential investors, fast-tracking your path to success. Are you ready to make it happen? You can apply now at BiggerPockets.com/CenterStreet. That's BiggerPockets.com/CenterStreet.
Top real estate investors love to talk about how they save so much on taxes. But how are they able to build rental property empires while skirting Uncle Sam? 1031 exchanges. 1031 exchanges allow you to defer capital gains taxes while you sell an investment property, exchanging your old property for a bigger, better one and avoiding the tax man while you do it. And that's where First American Exchange Company comes in. They're the leaders in 1031 exchanges. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting, First American Exchange can help you with simple rental property exchanges, complex commercial real estate investments, reverse exchanges, and more. Don't let your taxes eat into your profits. Visit First American Exchange Company at firstexchange.com or call them at 800-556-2520. That's firstexchange.com or 800-556-2520. Keep your money in your pocket and propel your portfolio further at firstexchange.com. First American Exchange Company does not provide tax or legal advice. Consult your financial, real estate, tax, or legal advisor about your circumstances. First American Exchange Company. Safe, smart, secure.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
Welcome back to the On the Market podcast.
As an analyst of the housing market, one of the defining features of the last few years has been low foreclosures. You know, a lot of people were expecting, either due to COVID or, you know, inflation, all these other sort of things that are going on, that foreclosures might start rising. And while they have come up from pandemic levels, they're still historically low. Is one possible explanation for that the fact that things are going to receivership instead of going to foreclosure?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a likely contributing factor. Receiverships have become a lot more common lately within the past 5 years or so. And as they become more and more common, bankruptcy filings actually have been trending downward because, you know, it is an alternative to a bankruptcy.
Jake, do you have any further advice to any investors considering working with receivers on how they can get into this type of transaction?
Well, I would say, like with most things, talk to a trusted professional. Seek out a broker that you're familiar with, you know, either personally or by reputation, that knows about receiverships and has been through the process, because there is a learning curve. I'd say, just like with most things, you know, if somebody wants to invest in property, you can't just read a blog post and then go out and do it on your own. Find somebody who's done it to teach you how to do it.
On the other side of that, Jake, you know, there has been investors that have gotten themselves into trouble. They took on a lot of expensive debt. They got a little bit over their head. And the investment at the end of the day is just going bad because the market conditions change. They could be great people. They could have great operations. But maybe their performance was a little too packed and it just kind of changed. How is it beneficial to an investor to work with the receiver to kind of get themselves out of that mess, right? Because a lot of those loans are personally guaranteed. They're full recourse loans and they don't want that debt to follow them. What's the benefit for them going through the receivership? And then can you also touch on what that does to their credit and how that is going to affect them down the road?
Primary benefits of getting the receivership started is, once a receiver is appointed, the court imposes a stay similar to a bankruptcy stay, to where it stops all collection activities. And so it gives a bit of a pause so that everybody can assess the situation and start a dialogue on the best way to resolve the situation, whether it's giving the collateral to the creditor or getting it sold at an agreed upon price. But that kind of pause and breathing room, it gives the opportunity to analyze the situation and plan a little bit more. It could affect their credit, you know, depending on whether or not the creditor reports them, you know, if they report the loan as a default. But the interesting thing about it is that the process varies from state to state. Like, every state has different receivership laws. And because it's different, instead of a uniform system like a bankruptcy, credit reporting agencies, they don't have a uniform way to deal with it. So I'd say, by and large, it doesn't really impact credit scores because there's no uniform way to report it and get it out to the credit reporting agencies.
So essentially, an investor, if they get in over their head, needs to hire you so they can get themselves out of the mess and they get to kind of get a new, fresh lease on life and go do deals in another market or another type of deal.
So, yeah, and I'd agree with the sentiment and the conclusion, but with caveat or correction that they wouldn't be hiring me. So the receiver is an agent of the court and not a fiduciary or representative of either the creditor or the debtor.
Got it.
All right, great. Well, Jake, thank you so much for joining us and sharing what is, I think, probably a new part of the real estate investing world for most of our audience. At least it was for me. I really enjoyed learning about it. And thanks so much for your time.
All right. Thanks a lot, Dave. Thanks a lot, James.
Big thanks to Jake for joining us today. If you want to connect with him or learn more about his business, as usual, we will put his contact information in the show notes below. James, hopefully you learned a couple tricks and tips for your own work with receivers today.
You know what? I'm always looking for more tips and tricks to get more deals done. But as long as those nasty bump clauses don't come at me, everything will be fine.
All right, great. Well, thanks for suggesting the show topic. And thank you all for listening. We'll see you for the next episode soon of On the Market.
On the Market was created by me, Dave Meyer, and Kaylin Bennett. The show is produced by Kaylin Bennett with editing by Exodus Media. Copywriting is by Calico Content. And we want to extend a big thank you to everyone at Bigger Pockets for making this show possible.
Investing in small multifamily properties is probably the most popular niche in the entire Bigger Pockets community, and there's a good reason for that. You can put as little as 3.5% down and own up to 4 units. So just think about that for a second. You can house hack where you live in one of the units, but in addition to having a place to live, you still have 3 different groups of tenants helping to pay down your mortgage each month. You have 4 kitchens and bathrooms that you could add value to build equity. You could also turn one or more of the properties into a short-term rental or a medium-term rental. And all this, what I'm describing here, is just one transaction. But of course, the question is, where do you find one of these small multifamily properties that you can afford? Which markets and which deals are best for you? How about after you close? How do you manage it, optimize it, keep scaling and living your life without being tied down by four leaky toilets or four fussy tenants? These are all great questions. And luckily for you, they're going to be answered in the upcoming Small Multifamily Bootcamp with Chris Lopez and Leka Devatha. So if you're serious about growing your portfolio with this highly efficient, great strategy, head to biggerpockets.com/4 today and join us in the Small Multifamily Bootcamp. I'll see you there.
The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only. Past performance is not indicative of future results, and all hosts and participant opinions are their own. Investments in any asset, real estate included, involves risk. Use your best judgment and consult with qualified advisors before investing. Only risk capital you can afford to lose. Bigger Pockets LLC disclaims all liability for direct, indirect, consequential, or other damages arising from reliance upon information presented in this podcast.